quite some time in having problems in the marriage, communication issues, struggles that resulted in conflict. On a fairly regular basis, decided that it was time to do something, and so they sought out counseling and went in for their first session. During the session, they went through their list of issues, defending each of their positions vehemently and holding fast to what they called their principal position. The counselor listened carefully and sympathetically along the way, and after much discussion and after much time spent going through these standards and principles that they both were defending against each other, the counselor said, "If I could get you to care about as much about the person that you are married to as you do about defending your principle, we can probably fix this." A lot of times we get so caught up in defending our own position, our own principle, that we forget entirely that God has not made us for principle, but for people. Now, please don't confuse what I'm saying in the illustration. I'm not suggesting that anything goes. I'm not suggesting that you compromise the values of the Word of God and what He has taught us in it. What I am saying is that many times we take our own position, our own principled position, and we stand upon it not because it's the best place for us to be, but because it is the place that gives us the greatest leverage over others. That is not what Jesus did, though He, among all, would certainly have the superiority and the place to do that. But rather, He taught us that whoever would be first must be last. Whoever would be greatest must be the least. And He taught us and modeled for us that whoever would gain His life must lose it. The gospel is always going to turn upside down whatever you think you know. It's going to challenge us at the deepest level of what we think we believe. And in so doing, is going to then reorder our lives in a way that more closely reflects Christ Himself and the call that He has given to all believers, so that the world doesn't see us as blending into its system of sinful confusion, but rather sees us standing apart, offering hope and light and life. So the title of the message is "The Welfare of People versus the Freedom of Principle." The welfare of people versus the freedom of principle. 1 Corinthians chapter 8 is a passage that may be more familiar than some of the others that we've seen thus far in our study of 1 Corinthians. However, it is also one that, in spite of its familiarity, is often misquoted, misunderstood, and misapplied. And so we're going to try to correct some of that today, and at least, if nothing else, give greater clarity to this small portion of text. Remember, last week we talked about Paul introducing in chapter 7 the fact that he is responding to a letter that they have written. So they've written a letter to him, and this is still part of that. There is another issue or another question that has arisen, and so it was included in the letter. Paul now replies to that question regarding the subject of meat and the eating of this meat that had previously been offered as a sacrifice to the idols of false gods. And so how is the Christian community to respond to this? What are the distinctives that are involved in it? And how does it break down along this subject of considering the welfare of people as over and against the freedom of our own principles? We'll see that as we go through. Beginning first of all with knowledge that is without love is actually very dangerous. In chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, it says, concerning food offered to idols, we know that all of us possess knowledge. This knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he is known by God. So, what is Paul telling us and how is he introducing it? He's beginning with a universal higher principle that's going to go over and above that of what the Corinthians think they know or what they are currently standing upon. And so he's trying to help them to understand that these higher principles are going to govern everything else that is secondary. He says, concerning the food offered to idols. Remember, Corinth is a very evil city. It is completely consumed with paganism and false gods. They're everywhere. It runs the full gamut of everything from the previously mentioned sexual immorality to now this sort of thing that has affected them economically, to the point where when people would come to these places in order to worship these false gods, they would bring animals, most often a lamb. The lamb would be killed, and then it would be burned on an altar. Now, not burned up, burned to about medium well, and that would be it. Generally, they would add to that some sort of herbs or things like that. We call that dry rub today. And so as a result of that, what do you get? You get a really good smell, a really good smell. If you've ever walked by a steakhouse near where the vent fan is exhausting out and you smell that grilling meat, you know what that smells like. Now, I realize that some people don't like meat. At least that's what they tell me. I have trouble associating with that, and I've been a carnivore for way too long to really relate well to that. But hey, whatever. Even if you don't eat it, you would probably have to agree that it does smell good when it's cooking, and especially roasting. So what they would do then is they would gather this meat after it had been offered in this sacrificial system, and then they would serve it in these temples to the false gods. So what you had was worship and a restaurant all together. They would sell the meat that the people would come there to eat. Now, only those who had significant wealth would be able to afford this, and only those who could take advantage of the status that was associated with it would do that. And so what it did was it not only created a confusion and conflicting issue for these new believers, but it also was starting to affect those who were maybe not in that social stratus where they could afford that or that economic position. And so it just further divided people. Remember, the gospel never is intended to divide. It is always intended to unite. If the gospel does not bring us together, then something is desperately wrong with the way we are applying it in our lives or in our churches. And churches are notorious for this. We find churches that appeal to various groups of people, whether it breaks down because of social standing or because of economic standing or because of tradition or something else. A lot of times we find that churches tend to alienate people rather than include them. And we have to constantly resist that tendency. And so this is something that was going on in the church there, but it was happening around this confusing mix of this meat that was being offered to these false gods then served in these temples. Now, some of the meat was not served there. Some of it was taken out into the marketplace where it was sold. And so there it would become more available to those who maybe didn't have the status to go into the temple and consume it there. They could go purchase it at a discounted rate in the marketplace, then take it home and consume it there or share it with friends. So here's the deal. There are some who are now very high-minded. We know that these pagan gods mean nothing. We know that this false ritual means nothing. Why shouldn't we enjoy the benefit of this meat and this food that has been offered to these gods? Why? What's the big deal? It doesn't have any effect on us spiritually. However, there are other people who see it in a very different way. They've been taught all of their lives that if you eat the meat offered to these false gods, you will gain some sort of benefit, either some sort of fortune or some sort of financial benefit or physical benefit of healing or something like that. And so many times the reason that they ate this false, ate the meat that was offered to these false gods was to curry the favor of them. So these people have now been converted to Christianity. They are followers of Jesus. But what's happening is kind of a syncretism, which often occurs, especially in pagan cultures, where they are blending together the false worship and the true worship, and these new believers who are immature in their faith and do not possess the understanding that comes from extended discipleship are looking at these believers who supposedly are mature in their faith and saying, well, if they're eating this meat, it must be okay. And if we follow their pattern, then maybe we will still get not only salvation from Jesus, but also benefit from false gods. That's syncretism. That isn't just a corrupting of true doctrine. It is a replacing it with false doctrine. Now, where do we see that in the world? Well, we actually see it everywhere. I just mentioned the team that is going to Guatemala. I've never seen syncretism more on display than what I see there, where they take the Mayan culture and the Mayan worship and blend it together with Catholicism so clearly that the Catholic churches, most of which are built on what had previously been Mayan places of worship, the Catholic churches have stopped even trying to convert them to true Catholicism or Christianity and have made a place for them to continue their Mayan worship rituals in their Catholic churches. So that you go into some of the Catholic churches, there'll be a priest standing there to greet you, and there'll be a priest of a Mayan religion standing there as well. You'll have a place on the outside steps where people are coming in order to greet the Christians and other members of the church, but over to the side of it will be a place where incense or sacrifices are being offered on the steps of the church to Mayan gods. It's syncretism. What does it do? It means that you've taken the false teachings and you've blended them together with truth so that now everything's false. Everything. What Paul was trying to help them to understand is that your high-mindedness in this whole business and your defense of your personal liberty and your position of principle was in fact putting younger or perhaps developing believers at risk. He said that doesn't work. So the issue concerning food offered to idols, that's the background and context. He said we know all of us possess knowledge. He said this knowledge is that this stuff doesn't matter. This knowledge, however, has puffed up. It's made you prideful and arrogant. Instead, love is building up. Love is what enables you to be built up in your relationship with Christ, but also how you can help others to grow up in their faith and be built up as well. Knowledge that you are clinging to is making you prideful and arrogant, but love that transforms us makes us sensitive and humble. In verse 3, he says, but if anyone loves God, he is known by God. He reminds us that loving God is not something that you or I do by initiative. Loving God and accepting the gift of salvation that comes through Jesus Christ is the means by which you and I are reminded that even before we had an inkling of desire for salvation. He first loved us. It's not how much you know God. It's how much you are known by God. Salvation is the awareness that even before we became aware of our need, He knew us, called us from before the foundations of the earth. I think a lot of times our faith is so wrapped up in our own stuff and our own activity and our own initiative that we forget that every moment is a moment of grace. I was reading our Sunday school lesson for today, and one of the quotes from another source that's included on the sidebar of the teacher's guide said that a good way to be humbled in our faith, and I'm not quoting it, I'm just paraphrasing, is to remember that everything that we have comes by the grace of God. And a good way to be reminded of that is to think about it in terms of every breath. Be aware of the breath that you draw. Because every breath is the evidence of God's grace. Do you ever think about the very breath that you draw, the very air that we breathe? We had nothing to do with that. It is all entirely the work of God, and it is altogether dependent on the hand of God. Knowledge without love is dangerous. Knowledge puffs us up and makes us the kind of arrogant and difficult people that we are so prone to become on our own. But love builds up. It builds us up in the faith, but it also enables us to build up others. If we think we know something, we probably don't. Verse 2 is the reminder of that. Just because you think you know something, the greater knowledge is in understanding what we don't know. And loving God is not about how you and I go about it. Loving God is about how you and I realize that God has first loved us in Jesus Christ. Knowledge without love is dangerous then. Secondly, we know there is only one God. In verses 4 through 6, Paul kind of goes off on a teaching tangent. He says, therefore, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence and that there is no God but one. For although there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, from whom all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. And so Paul says, we know there is only one God. He reminds us of this. He is very likely quoting something that the Jews would have recognized from Deuteronomy as the Shema, and it would have been very familiar to them. But keep in mind that the Corinthians were, for the most part, Gentile believers, and they had no Jewish background. So he sort of modifies or simplifies the Shema, and he doesn't have a direct quote here, but one that is still true in principle, whether you were reading it from the Old Testament or the New. And he reminds them there is only one God. So we know that these idols are not real. We know that there's no benefit to eating food that has been offered to idols. As well, we know there is no detriment. There's nothing there. It doesn't make any difference. He said, we all understand that. And again, he's writing to the believers. He's writing to those who supposedly had the maturity and were able to teach others. He says there is no existence of these idols, that there's only one God. He said, now, don't misunderstand me. For although there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many and many lords, now he makes reference to demonic forces and to demonic evil. He's not saying that these gods are not real. What he's saying is they have no real power. And there are those elements of spiritual power that exist on this earth and beyond it that are associated with evil. But notice that he uses little g and little l. And he's talking about them by recognizing that there are spiritual influences of evil that we all must contend with. But the idea that there is some God that exists that is like the true God or that has power or authority. He said, no, we know that they don't exist, and we know that that isn't real. Now, the same thing can be said today. We understand that false gods are not real, but we also understand that evil uses these false gods to twist the minds of others and to ensnare people into this false teaching so that they are entrapped by it, and in so doing, there is a spiritual influence that is very real and must not be overlooked or should not be minimized to the point that we don't believe it to be of some consideration. Should we be afraid of it? We should not. Greater is he that is in me than he that is in the world. And we need to remember that evil is defeated. The devil is a defeated foe. That doesn't make him less real, but it does make him less powerful. And the only power that evil possesses in the life of the believer is that which we give to it. And so Paul really isn't teaching about that subject as much as he is trying to say, I do recognize that there is a spiritual influence, and he will address that later on in a different chapter and do so in a very specific way. For here, he just makes a passing glance at it. For the most part, he is reminding him that I understand that there's only one true God and one Lord, and that everything is made by him, and everything continues to exist through him. Quickly, look at that last verse, verse 6, because I don't want to leave this point until that is firmly in your mind, so that when he said there is one God, the Father, from whom are all things, for whom we exist. One Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through whom we exist. Now, I think that we forget this. This is part of the knowledge that puffs up. We forget that we have been made by him and that we exist because of him. And we are redeemed in him, and our redemption continues through him. So we read these types of verses and others that I have cited to you along the way, and it reminds us of the purpose of Temple Baptist Church. Temple Baptist Church exists for the glory of God through lives transformed by the gospel of Jesus Christ. This is an acknowledgement that we exist for the glory of God. We exist because of him and through him. Everything that we do and all that we are is dependent on God. And when we assert ourselves into positions of authority or power over other people or over the church or over any other issue, we forget our place. So he's calling us back to humility. He's reminding us that in order for us to love the weaker brother, we have to be humble before God. See the pattern setting up here? He said, look, I know that these idols and these false gods, they're not real. And because of that, there's nothing wrong with this food that we're talking about. He said, I understand all of that. But he said, you got to understand something else. This is an easy place for us to go awry and for others to suffer because of it. So he says, based on what you know and because you claim to know this, he reminds us that knowledge increases responsibility. Look at verse 7. However, not all possess this knowledge, but some, through former associations with idols, eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. Immature believers do not understand the truth about these false gods, is what he's saying. These new believers are people that we are sharing the gospel with who may become believers soon. They don't understand this. They don't make this distinction. Now, how do we relate this to our current situation? It's the same thing throughout every age and regardless of the social structure or the religious context that we're working in. Believers who have maturity in their faith have a responsibility to non-believers as well as to the weaker believer. I think there's been a reaction that has taken place within the church against traditionalism over the last few years. And I think probably some of you may even think that I'm part of that reaction. That isn't really true, but I can certainly see how it would look that way. And the reaction is that just because we've done something doesn't mean we need to continue doing it. And so as we've seen some change and transition take place in the way we do church and in the way we do ministry and the way we do missions because of the changing nature of the culture that we're a part of, I think a lot of times those who are a part of the change, once we gain a little bit of momentum, can start to feel a little bit prideful about that and a little bit maybe too far. So we start saying, well, you know, I have all this freedom because of my faith in Jesus. I can do this and it doesn't affect my relationship with Christ. I can do this and it doesn't affect my relationship with Christ. I know that traditionally, you know, Baptists didn't do that or Christians didn't do this, and on and on and on this list goes. And you can plug in whatever vice or particular issue you want to. But the real issue isn't about what you're free to do. It's about how your freedom reflects the gospel. So are you telling me, Scott, that you know I can do all this stuff and say I'm not going to really affect my relationship with Jesus? I'm not going to go to hell for it? But because of somebody else who hasn't achieved that level of understanding and spiritual maturity, I have to curtail my activities? Yes, that is exactly what I'm telling you. Glad you got it the first time. Well, that doesn't seem fair. Now you sound immature again. Now you sound childish again. This is where we find ourselves in the Christian community so many times, defending a position that we think is important when in reality all we're doing is harming those around us that we are responsible for. Immature believers do not understand the truth about these false gods, Paul said. They grew up in this. This is all they've ever known. They haven't had time to understand the teachings of the doctrines of the scriptures and of Jesus Christ. And they haven't had time to develop a distance from that past and from that corruption that they'd known before. And so as a result, if they participate in this because they see you doing it, it's going to affect them. They're already in this state of weakness, and now they are going to be defiled and they're going to feel guilty, and there's going to be an offense of their conscience. And he's saying that we, as the established believers, that we are responsible for that. Food will not commend us to God. We're no worse off if we do not eat, and we're no better off if we do. He's saying, I understand that. I realize that this food offered to false gods neither benefits nor harms. But, he says in verse 9, take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. He says that while it is true and we agree that this isn't something that's going to harm or to help, and it really is not even a matter for concern, it is a matter of concern if our position or our liberty causes others to stumble. Then in verse 10 he says, for if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged if his conscience is weak to eat food offered to idols? It is possible. So that others who see what we do that may not have the strength of maturity that you possess are now going to be subject to act on it in a way that could be detrimental to them. So that he says in verse 11, by your knowledge this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. The key here is not to feel like you need to limit your life. The key here is to realize that what Paul is teaching us is that everything that we do in this life matters, and we don't do any of it in secret. He's also reminding us that spiritual maturity is going to move us to a position so that the principle that we hold on to so tightly and so dearly, even at the expense of destroying a weaker brother or sister, that principle is something that we care more for than the person. It represents a liberty, it represents a freedom, or it represents something that we want to do. And so we've decided we're going to do that, and we're going to do that at all cost. And that if you want to be a part of this, then you just need to grow up and be mature like I am and agree with me. And that may not be what's at stake here. That may not even be what is being taught here. In fact, the very moment that we think we know something, he said, you don't. The moment that we care more for our own positions or principles than we do for the people that they could harm is the moment we have moved outside the realm of grace to which we've been called. This is a really important passage, and it puts things into perspective for all of us because it reminds us that mature believers must be sensitive to the immature and understand that all of us are going through various stages of maturity and immaturity. He says in verse 9, take care that this does not somehow become a stumbling block for the weak. For anyone who sees you eating in an idol's temple could be encouraged, if his conscience is weak, to eat the food offered to idols. And so, by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. Thus, sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. And here's the key. The issue is not our sin against another or obligation to them. It is that when we sin against Christ. Now, what does that mean? It means that Christ dwells in you. And when you do that which is contrary to his nature and his righteousness, you are sinning against yourself, but also against him. It doesn't just wound your conscience, it wounds Christ within you. Now, it doesn't cause any sin that you or I commit to be added to Jesus or to diminish him. What it does is it creates a conflict within you, where on the one hand you have Christ dwelling in richness, glory, and righteousness, and on the other hand now you have pride and a lack of humility combined with sinfulness. And you put those two together, what happens? It's awkward and uncomfortable and it feels bad. We call that conviction. Exactly what it is. It is conviction. So he says to us that we need to be mindful of those around us, not because of just them. Don't focus your attention on the other person. Focus your attention on Jesus. So that he says in verse 13, therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat lest I make my brother stumble. Now, does Paul say that he never ate meat again? He doesn't say that. He says that if my eating meat, and that's the only meat available, is this meat that's been offered to these false gods, if my doing that causes my brother to stumble, I would never eat meat again. And notice how he dismisses it glibly. Now, Paul doesn't come from quite the same carnivorous culture that you and I are a part of. But what he's saying is there's nothing that you can eat, no oral satisfaction that you could ever derive from food that can equal the satisfaction of obedience to Christ and of effectiveness in the gospel. And I think what this does, when we think about a declaration such as he makes in verse 13, it reminds us of how connected we are to things that don't matter. The things of this earth, whether it is food or whether it is drink or whether it is something else or some sort of activity or some place or some group of people that we're associated with, or status or standing or money or wealth or possessions or whatever it is, you make the list. Anything that is not going to endure the judgment fires that will come when Jesus returns. You just take all of that and lump it together. Any of that stuff that we hold on to the exclusion of the gospel and to the lack of concern for those who are lost, is putting our faith and putting us in that faith in jeopardy. There are more people who are not Christians today because of the Christians they know than of those that they don't. You go all the way back to the beginning. Cain and Abel. You know the conflict that existed, the jealousy that raged. So that eventually, brother killed brother. God comes knocking. Did he tell us why? He did. He said that the blood of the slain cries out from the ground to me. Where is your brother? And what did Cain say? Am I my brother's keeper? Be careful when you adopt the attitude of the murderer. Be careful when you adopt the attitude of the one who will be banished for his sin. Be careful when you adopt the attitude that dismisses the needs of those around you in favor of your own prideful awareness. We are not quite so intelligent as we think we are. We are not quite so sophisticated as we think we are. Wouldn't it be wonderful if what we really were striving for was greater humility and surrender before Jesus? Maybe if we cared more for Christ, we would care more for people than for mere principle. And I think that is our problem.